You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WBIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast, which is aired and distributed on WBIK, public radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is someone I've been looking forward to having on the show for quite a while. He's John Barry, and he's author of an incredible book about the 1918 pandemic. You can imagine that this book captured widespread interest in light of the coronavirus pandemic we're currently facing. The book is called The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History, and John's here today to talk about his book and then perhaps some lessons that the 1918 pandemic holds for us today. John, thank you so much for being our guest today.
My pleasure. I know your area a little bit for another book. I spent a lot of time at the Hoover Library and sort of a river rat.
Yeah. Well, I would love to have, I'll just say it now, I'd love to have you back sometime and talk about that book. John's referencing The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. So that would be an interesting topic as well. But this one, of course, especially timely. You probably had no idea when you set out to write this book that this would, we'd be dealing with this crisis we're facing today.
Well, you know, not precisely, but if you know anything about infectious disease and viruses, then you knew a pandemic of some respiratory virus was inevitable, and we've got one.
Yeah, this there's some parallels we can talk about as we get into our story, but I was interested in reading the book that something I learned anew here, that the virus actually started in the Heartland region, in the middle of the country.
It may have. To be honest, in the book, I advanced an idea which actually got a fair amount of traction, that it started in rural Kansas. But there's been a lot of epidemiological work since the book came out in 2004. And my own views, honestly, have shifted. I think Kansas is still a possibility, but I think it's more likely China. Some other hypotheses are France, Vietnam, so it's not limited to Asia, possibly even New York City.
Interesting.
But we will probably never know. And as I said, the Kansas hypothesis remains a possibility.
Would you take it from rural Kansas into how this spread so widely in the United States? Because, of course, we were with World War One, we were gearing up and bringing a lot of people close together, unfortunately.
Yeah, that certainly accelerated the spread. I don't think the war was a major factor in doing anything other than accelerating spread. I think the virus entered the population. There's no evidence that the trenches, I know there's a theory, but that the close proximity of men in trenches ended up creating a more virulent virus. Thomas Huxley said the great tragedy of science is a beautiful hypothesis slain by an ugly fact. I think all the evidence is against that idea, but it did accelerate the spread. Instead of having, it does look like American soldiers carried the virus to Europe in the spring of 1918, and instead of having 1 or 10 or 20 infected people going to Europe, you have tens of thousands. Hundreds of thousands. So injecting that many infected people did speed things. The world that was not at war, had no relationship to the war, they got sick too. And other than speeding things up again, I don't think the war played a major factor.
This book is interesting on so many levels. And one is how it details how I don't want to say primitive, but less advanced our system of public health was at that time. And I think you wrote that only one school, there was only one one medical school that required a college degree at the time to become a doctor.
Well, by 1918, that had changed, but is late as the founding of the Johns Hopkins Medical School, which was around 1890, roughly. That was the case. Hopkins was the first. Most of the medical schools in the country, the faculty was supported entirely by student tuition, so they had no inclination to reject anybody. And even at Harvard, you took 9 courses. They were all lecture courses. This is in the 1870s. Nobody at Harvard knew how to use a microscope. This is after Pasteur was making incredible advances. You could fail 4 out of 9 courses and still get an MD from Harvard. Hopkins changed that very dramatically and very rapidly. And then in 1910, there was something called the Flexner Report, which was an expose of just how bad most medical schools were. And overnight, an enormous number of medical schools either merged or went out of business. And things, you know, right now, there is no bad medical school in the United States. There are some that are better than others, but they're all very good. And that's a direct result of the influence of Johns Hopkins and a guy named William Welch, whom I write about at length, and also the Flexner Report.
And you called Welch arguably the single most influential scientist in the world at the time, and I'd never heard of him. And again, for our listeners,
Without any doubt, he was the most important person in the history of American medicine, and he may be the most important person in the history of American science.
I'd encourage our listeners to read this book. Again, it's got some important information on that event, but also some parallels to today. And one thing that was interesting was how a scientist began trying to find some type of vaccine or something to help ameliorate the effects of this, which were just horrible. What parallels do you see with that, with the present day, and how successful were they?
Well, there are a lot of parallels. You know, first, it's a respiratory virus that jumps species from animals to humans, as today. Highly transmissible, as today. Infected practically every organ in the body, which is extremely unusual, but it is the same with COVID-19. Spread throughout the world, same as today. And was a tremendous spur to the scientific community, same as today. There were a lot fewer scientists back then, but they were incredibly good. To give you a sense of how good they were, there was one guy who won the Nobel Prize in 1966 for work that he did in 1911. They won't give the Nobel Prize out unless they know you're right, and he was 55 years ahead of the curve. There's another scientist in the book who sort of was a personal hero of mine, named Oswald Avery, who started out looking at pneumonia, trying to solve the influenza problem, and ended up making probably the most important discovery in the 20th century in medicine. He figured out that DNA carried the genetic code, which was extremely controversial when he made that finding. In fact, he's probably the single person most deserving of the Nobel Prize who never won it. He was actually being considered for the prize for his work on immunology when he made that finding. They didn't give it to him because it was so controversial. And as you said, they were all working on vaccines. The problem was they didn't know what was causing the disease. Mm-hmm. When you make a vaccine, obviously you have to target the pathogen that is creating the disease. And there was some slight suspicion that it might be what we now call a virus. But back then, they didn't even know what a virus was, whether it was a really, really, really small bacteria with the same kind of organism as a bacteria, or something entirely different. In fact, research coming out of the pandemic figured out that a virus was a different organism than just what it was. But at the time, most people thought that a bacteria caused the disease. So if they were making vaccines against that bacteria, it wasn't going to do you much good. A lot of people did die, most people probably died of secondary bacterial infection. Even today, bacterial pneumonia following influenza has an 8% case mortality rate, which is pretty high. Back then, of course, it was more like 30% case mortality, since they had no antibiotics. If you were lucky enough to happen to have an infection with the bacteria that they thought was causing the disease and you got a vaccine against that bacteria, it probably did some good. But for most people, no. So again, like today, there was this tremendous energy in science and tremendous advances that came out of it. I mean, I just got a pneumonia shot yesterday against the pneumococcus. That is a straight line descendant of a vaccine that Oswald Avery developed back then. But that pandemic moved so quickly, much more quickly than COVID-19. They only had a matter of weeks, really, to figure anything out. And even today, in that short time frame, we couldn't have made any progress.
One sentence from the book I highlighted was, this is a quote, this is a story of science, of how one thinks, and of how one changes the way one thinks. And the first section of the book is called The Warriors, and highlights the work that these scientists did, which is really a salute to these folks back then, and by extension today, the folks that are working through these diseases to try to protect the public health and try to prevent something like this from happening again. So it's a really gripping story for as you follow us through.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting. Avery is, I said, a personal hero of mine, largely because he faced failure so much and kept going. He said, "Failure is my daily bread. I thrive on it." But he didn't thrive. He, you know, over a period of 20 years, he published nothing for almost 10 years, then published one thing, then published nothing for another period of almost 10 years, because all of his experiments were failing. And that's what a scientist does, is publish papers. You know, a prominent scientist will have hundreds of papers, and he's publishing one over a period of almost 20 years, failure after failure. And yet he stuck with it. In fact, Lloyd Carr, the Michigan football coach, former co-chair, of course, is a friend of mine. And when Michigan had what was then a down year for Michigan, it had some considerably worse years since, even told his team this, you know, the Avery story, to inspire them. I don't know if it worked, but, you know, he found it inspirational, as I did. I had a lot of trouble writing the book and frankly thinking of the failure that Avery kept facing day after day, helped me, keep going. You know, but he was like, you know, when you bracket a target with artillery, first long, then short, and you get closer and closer and closer. All those failures that he was having, he was learning something from each failure. And as I said earlier, he finally hit the target and concluded that DNA carried the genetic code.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today my guest is John Barry, the author of a book, The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History. This book was published in 2004. We've been talking a little bit about parts of the book. The tremendous aspect of this book that I've mentioned is the focus on scientists and health officials that are a time of innovation that preceded this. And again, this book has several levels to it that make it so good, but the part on public health, I think, is particularly interesting. But The other one that gets back to kind of the heart of the show, our focus is on politics and President Wilson. I mean, the more I read about this guy, the more I can understand why why his name's being taken down from schools throughout the country. But one of the reasons you say that that we struggled to contain this was directly attributable to some of the policies President Wilson had in place.
Well, he lied. Or I should say the government lied. Wilson never made a public statement of any kind on the pandemic. The situation was different, of course. We were at war. And Wilson focused everything in the government and tried to focus absolutely everything in the country on the war. So as part of that effort, he created something called the Committee for Public Information. And the architect of that committee said that truth and falsehood are arbitrary terms. Nothing in experience teaches us that one is superior to the other. And all that matters is the impact of what you say. So this committee had 100,000 what they called four-minute men that before every school board meeting, every vaudeville show, every public gathering of any kind, somebody would get up with the storyline of the day and talk for 4 minutes to try and inspire people to keep up their effort to win the war, whether they were in a factory or recruiting soldiers or selling war bonds. Morale was very important. Army camps banned songs like "I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now," because that was bad for morale. They banned the teaching of German in public schools and so forth and so on. At the same time, they also published Congress passed a law Wilson had asked for that made it punishable by 20 years in prison to, quote, utter, write, print, or publish any disloyal, scurrilous, profane, or abusive language about the government of the United States, unquote. Noticeably, truth was not a defense. They enforce this law vigorously, and a congressman was sentenced to 10 years in prison under this law. So that is the context. And to give Wilson, you know, to be fair, remember the largest demographic group in the United States then was German descent. So he wasn't confident that people of German descent would fight against Germany. Ireland was just rebelling against British rule. He wasn't certain Irish Americans would fight on the side of Britain. So he created all this propaganda arm, both the carrot and the stick. So that was the context in which influenza erupted. And it was called Spanish flu, not because it started in Spain. We do know it didn't start in Spain, even though we're not certain where it did start. But Spain wasn't at war, so it didn't censor its press, and they wrote about it. It became known as Spanish flu. And, you know, national public health leaders were saying things like, this is ordinary influenza by another name. It wasn't ordinary influenza by another name. People could die in 12 hours after the first symptoms. Some of the symptoms were horrific. You could bleed not just from your mouth or nose, but from your eyes and ears. Those are pretty scary symptoms.
Yes.
And most of the dead were people aged 18 to 45, otherwise healthy adults. Young, it was relatively young adults in many cases. The peak age for death was 28. Between 20 and 70% of pregnant women died. So this was horrific. And the government, there was plenty of fake news then, and it was all coming out of the government, which unfortunately is not that unusual. What was unusual in this case, instead of trying to tell the truth, the media echoed exactly what the government line was. For example, in Philadelphia, at a time when they are digging graves with steam shovels, when they finally belatedly closed down bars, restaurants, schools, theaters, and so forth, one of the newspapers actually said, quote, this is not a public health measure. You have no cause for panic or alarm, unquote. Really?
I mean,
how stupid did they think their readers were? And, you know, I could use other examples from elsewhere in the country like that. But the only impact of these lies were that people stopped believing anything that they were being told because they could see around them, you know, their neighbors dropping dead in a day. And, you know, in Philadelphia, the priests were literally driving horse-drawn carts through the streets calling upon people to bring out their dead. So they know it's not ordinary influenza by another name. And I think ultimately society is based on trust, and when trust evaporates, society begins to fray. It got so bad that at the very peak of the pandemic, a guy named Victor Vaughn, who before the war was dean of the University of Michigan Medical School and a very major figure in American medicine, and during the war, he was a colonel and head of communicable diseases for the Army. So he writes, if this current rate of acceleration continues for a few more weeks, civilization could easily disappear from the face of the earth. That's how bad it got. But he wrote that just at the peak, and things did get better.
Ironically, Wilson, as you write in this book, we've always been taught that he had a massive stroke, of course, later, and he did, but then while he was in Europe, he was a victim of this influenza.
Right. Yeah, in the middle of the peace negotiations. And one of, just like COVID-19, where one of the significant complications, neurological disorders, that was a very, very common complication of influenza. And it hit him right when he was negotiating the peace treaty. Everybody around him, from the White House usher, who was named Irwin Hoover, to Herbert Hoover, commented that they'd never seen him like this, that his brain wasn't functioning. The British Prime Minister, Lloyd George, commented on his, quote, nervous and spiritual breakdown in the middle of the peace conference, unquote. And it had a dramatic effect on what happened. Prior to the his illness, he had insisted on all the principles that America had gone to war over, that he said America went to war over, which was, you know, make the world safe for democracy and anti-imperialism and so forth. And he was so weakened and his mind wasn't really functioning when he was negotiating. In those days, I mean, today negotiations are really between staff, secretaries of state, and they bring things to the president. But then it was really just Wilson, Lloyd George, the British prime minister, and Clemenceau, the French prime minister, who were really cutting the deals themselves. Clemenceau's nickname was the Tiger, to give you an idea of his personality. And he just steamrolled Wilson. Wilson had been absolutely insistent before he got sick on all the principles the U.S. went to war over and totally caved in afterwards. John Maynard Keynes called him the greatest fraud on earth. A group of young aides, two of whom later became Secretary of State, met to decide whether or not they were all going to resign en masse. Not all of them did, but they were all discussed, and several of them did resign en masse. Not en masse, several of them did resign. So influenza had a major impact on that peace treaty, and of course, pretty much every historian has said that peace treaty was a significant factor in the rise of Hitler and the outbreak of World War II.
We just have a couple minutes left here, John. I just wanted to close. There's so much more here, but I encourage folks to, again, get a copy of the book.
Let me take over your show then and say that there are two lessons that came out of 1918.
Okay.
And when the George W. Bush administration started pandemic preparedness effort. I got involved in that. I was asked to because of my knowledge in 1918. I worked with the Obama administration during the 2009 pandemic. So I got into the policy making a little bit. The number one lesson from 1918 was to tell the truth. Lying costs people lives. That happened in 1918. Unfortunately, it's happening today too. The second issue is that non-pharmaceutical interventions, what do you do when you don't have drugs, work. Public health measures. The public health measures we're calling for today are exactly what they used in 1918. And, you know, we've studied 1918. It's pretty clear that the places that imposed controls earlier and kept them in place longer did better than those that did not. Not only in terms of how severe the pandemic was, but there was actually a study by, I think it was the Chicago Fed, although I may be wrong on exactly which Federal Reserve Bank did the study, but just earlier this year that concluded the cities that closed earlier and longer actually had a better economic recovery than those that did not. And I think that lesson's important and one that we still need to keep in mind today.
Okay, that was actually pretty close to what my final question was going to be. So I appreciate you outlining that, John. My guest today has been John Barry, the author of The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History, a topic obviously with very important parallels to today. And again, I encourage folks to go get a copy and read. You'll see more in there about some of the things we're trying now with distancing and masks and quarantines. But a lot of parallels today, some important differences. But a great book on the pandemic, but all the elements that go with it, and public health, government politics, a lot of different areas. John, again, thank you so much for being my guest today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. We'll be right back.